virtual couch.
Welcome to the virtual couch, where my girl Leticia hits you with the latest topics with her unique swag and spicy sauce that keep you wanting more.
Ooh wee, girl, you doing your thing.
Let's see if they can handle some more of that fire. Keep dropping them gems,
Leticia.
Well, February is Black History Month, and a local publication called The Official Black Magazine is working to promote black mental health awareness all month long. The publisher and the founder of The Official Black Magazine, Michael Cox, joins us now to talk more about it. Hey, Michael, good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Logan. How are you doing?
Doing great. Tell me a little bit about your magazine and what you're doing for Black History Month.
Okay, perfect. Our lifestyle magazine, we celebrate Black excellence. We celebrate everything from Black travel to fashion to beauty to entrepreneurship. So just the myriad of everything that is Black. So that's the best part about the publication. And then for Black History Month, for a mental health awareness, what we're doing is making sure we highlight, a lot of articles, a lot of things that help people within the community understand things of how to identify if you see things like nervous breakdowns, if you need to identify if someone you can tell is going through some type of mental health issue, and how to make sure that you can communicate with them or at least give them the resources. So when you go to the website, the first thing you'll see up there is a crisis hotline and resources for those who need to have conversations, if it's LGBTQIA+, or if it's veterans, things that people are dealing with. We want to make sure, especially recently, with a lot of suicides happening from local individuals to high profiles, that we really do our part as an African-American publication for the community.
Yeah, and I'm just reading some new studies show a rise in African-American males battling mental health issues. What do you think's going on with that?
You know, honestly, it's a lot of stigma sometimes, especially because we need to really normalize therapy. We need to normalize, having those conversations instead of saying that someone's, acknowledging people are having internal pains and not trying to just push it off as maybe someone's like, not talking or not wanting to talk. Sometimes people don't even know how to identify what they're going through. So one thing that we are trying to really promote within the community is actually normalizing having conversations and having the resources and the education. If you see, there are some statistics that shows the second leading cause of death in Black adolescents between 10 and 19 is suicide. And within the last recent years, especially like in the last 30 years, it's been an increase about 47% in suicide rates for Black men and over 50% increase in African-American women.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great issue, really important. Tell me a little bit about this month and what it means to you personally.
For me, this month means to honestly do my part. Sometimes we use this month as a way to celebrate different parts of our community, but right now the message is to make sure that I'm doing my part, and the publication of my team is to make sure that we put forward Black mental health awareness. So that's really our goal right now. So this whole month, that's what you're going to see: positive messaging, words of affirmation, resources, also a directory of Black psychologists, therapists, life coaches that you can talk to that come from the same socioeconomic and cultural background.
Where can people find more information about The Official Black Magazine?
They can go to www.theofficialblackmagazine.com. You can see that we do have our digital issues. We do have our print issues. But right now, the most important part is just really sharing those resources. You go there, you'll see how to even deal with a difficult family sometimes. Sometimes we can love our family, and sometimes our family can drive us up the wall. So
they can be tough, can't they?
especially right now, they can really be tough. So we want to make sure that people, honestly, you just want to have a conversation. Sometimes, Logan, that's all you need, is someone to listen, but also someone that you can just vent to.
Yeah, I hear that.
Happy February and happy Black History Month, you guys. And this month's theme is Black health and wellness. I don't know if you were familiar with this, but every year there's a specific theme. So I will pay homage to myself and some of my wonderful colleagues and other individuals in the healthcare field, especially especially this year, being that we're coming off of a tumultuous year and we're kind of still going through it, right? We're still in the pandemic. So I want to honor some heroes and just highlight some issues within the African-American community, the Black community, and also some things that you need to know to make sure that you are healthy, that you are being proactive in your health, not reactive, proactive, meaning that you're taking the necessary steps to remain healthy and preventative measures. So please stay tuned. The information provided on this platform is for informational purposes only. If you ever find yourself becoming triggered, please refrain from listening. If you ever feel like you want to hurt yourself or hurt someone else, please dial 911 or report to your nearest emergency room. Thank you.
As we mentioned, though, to you earlier, very sad weekend for the entertainment world, for the world, period. The death of award-winning actress and director Regina King's child brings an extreme heartache through Hollywood and, of course, the Black community. Like I said, everywhere. I mean, Regina is loved by everybody. I had a very informative interview with Dr. Joanne Frederick about the signs of suicide along with prevention just moments ago. And, yeah, you got to pick up on some of those signs. You got to pay attention a lot, Shannon, because this comes out of nowhere. Sometimes you just see people who are full of life, and sometimes the happiest people. And that's why they always say, check on your strongest friends. Because sometimes your strongest friends are the ones that need the most help. Yeah. I was one of those guys that always put on this strong facade, always happy, always trying to make everybody else happy. Meanwhile, I'm suffering in silence. So you never know who could be dealing with somebody. So always just check on them. Say, hey, man, you okay? Everything good? Even when you think they're happy. Still check on your friends. Make sure you do that, and your family members.
And it's so important to get past the stigma associated with it. You talk about stronger people. Well, 78% of all people who die by suicide are actually men. That's according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, because I think you talk about being strong. A lot of times men are supposed to be strong. They're not supposed to share their feelings. They have all these emotions, and they go through these things and don't know how to deal with them, don't know how to cope with them. And that's when the help comes in. That's when the mental health comes in. That's when talking to someone and checking on other people come into play. And don't forget about the guys that are involved in these suicides also, that are the fathers, the brothers, the cousins. Because Ian had a father. Mm-hmm. He has a father, Ian Alexander Sr.
Yep.
You know, his feelings and his emotions are going to play this. It's not just Regina King that's affected by this. All the men in his life also have to now cope with this too, which could cause depression or sadness that they're dealing with. So, and any time that people are going through this type of thing, surround them with love, prayer, care, and check on them. And not only in this situation, but in everyday life, check on them.
Yeah, and that's a really good point that you brought up, because a lot of people saying, and Regina, of course, is suffering, and but Ian, his father's going through the same thing. That's his son, and a son that, you know, you have a lot of questions and asking yourself, what more could you have done? Like I said, I lost a cousin last year, and her mom is still asking, what more could she have done? She didn't see this. Obviously, she was going through some things. Apparently, she was going through some things with her boyfriend, but you never think it's going to get to that point. But yeah, just check on people, because it's important, and know that if you're going through these things, that there are brighter days ahead. Mm-hmm. And I live my life one day at a time now, and I wake up every morning and I thank God for the blessing that he's given me. And I don't know how spiritual people are, but I'm very spiritual when it comes to that. Maybe not religious, but spiritual. I just thank God that I have breath in my body, because I always say that I'm far from perfect, but I'm better than most. And you have to understand that no matter how bad you think it is, sometimes you have it a lot better than a lot of people in this world. Mm-hmm. But you still have to continue to try, because tomorrow could be that day where everything turns around. So if you need help, there is help available. There's a lot of people to talk to. Once again, the suicide prevention hotline is out there, but also just your friends, your family, your pastors, everybody. Once again, 1-800-273-TALK. Is the suicide prevention lifeline that you can reach out to once again. And if you feel that way, please speak up, because you know you're leaving life behind, but also there are a lot of family members out there who always have these questions that they will never more than likely get the answer to as well.
Yeah, and don't forget that that is anonymous also. You don't have to tell them your name. You can just call them and just talk to them, and they'll talk you mm-hmm. through your emotions and your feelings that you go through. If you don't think you can talk to somebody in your family, although there are a lot of people out there that I'm sure love you, even if you don't realize it, and even if you don't think someone loves you now, there could be a lot of people that can share your love in the future if you're here to share it. So stay with us, not only on the show, but also in life.
Hey, you guys, and welcome back. Now, this Black History Month, I'm taking the liberty to highlight healthcare heroes, as well as some of the issues that still continue to plague the Black community. Now, hold on, this is not to damper the mood, you guys. It's just to take an analytical look for the purposes of being proactive and having a corrective stance. Now, we are giving honor to our excellent Carter G. Woodson, because without him, we wouldn't even be celebrating. And if you don't know who Carter G. Woodson is, he was an American historian, author, journalist, and founder of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, who created, it was a week-long celebration before, and it was created in 1926. So Black History Month was actually Black History Week in 1926. It became Black History Month a little bit later. Now, Mr. Carter G. Woodson did all of this to raise awareness for Black Americans' contributions to history, right? Couldn't even get that out. So in 1926, let's say that again, he wanted to raise awareness for Black Americans' contributions to history. And if you know anything about our wonderful history, our history is American history, right? So I kind of hate to say, and I said kind of cringing when we say Black history, because our history makes America. It definitely does. You know, some of us don't want to remember, but you know what? In order to go forward, we have to look backwards, right? As painful as it may be, because when we look backwards, we are more apt to not make the mistakes of our past. And of course, you know, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but the things of the past, of course, a lot of those things wasn't in our control. And we know that, right? So moving forward, because we don't want to stay backwards, right? The theme of this year, 2022 Black History Month, is Black health and wellness. Now, I have to admit, I never knew that there were themes every year. You guys, did you guys know that? And I'm glad I found out the theme of this year, because it holds near and dear to my heart, being that I am all things health and wellness, being a mental health therapist, and just loving to take care of myself and help taking care of others. But this year, we are exploring the legacy of medical practitioners, scholars, doulas, birth workers, mental health therapists and practitioners, midwives, herbalists, and a lot more. Medical doctors, of course, right? And I believe it's extremely important we continue to celebrate the past and present heroes who've made voluntary and not so voluntary, involuntary sacrifices, pushing the medical field forward for global benefit and consumption. Today, many of our heroes, specifically Black people who are already oppressed systematically, are now facing our own health crisis with COVID, being that, you know, the numbers are very staggering for the African-American community. And a lot of our African-American sisters and brothers, Black sisters and brothers, are healthcare workers. And, you know, being that we've lost so many to COVID this year, and, you know, it just seemed like we just had a global bereavement. And not only that, a lot of our healthcare workers today are being faced with a lot of backlash from the drastic
dissenting views. And I said this is drastic from last year, because last year around this time, you know, our healthcare heroes were looked at as pillars of the community, which we are. And I'm specifically talking about the ones who are working more in the hospitals. And I did work in the hospital last year, but in my profession, I'm looked more as I don't want to use the word savior, but in a way, I will say that, because usually when people are coming for mental health therapy, they are coming on their own most of the time, you know, not all the time, because sometimes it's mandated by the courts. But in my case, I don't see any mandated individuals right now. But I'm saying all that to say, a lot of our doctors and a lot of our nurses and other professions in the hospitals are receiving a lot of backlash from different, you know, of course, the vaccine has been widely politicized, and you have a lot of dissenting views about whether to take it or not. And a lot of our healthcare workers are really feeling the brunt of all of that, and they're being abused a lot of the time. So send your prayers and good thoughts out to my fellow sisters and brothers, because, you know, the work is not easy at all. I worked in the hospitals last year in Bronx, New York, the Bronx, like my second home now. And it was hard. It was really hard. And you don't really see what goes on behind the scenes. So I'm so glad that this year we are commemorating not only Black History Month, but there's a theme, and that is honoring our healthcare heroes. So today I wanted to touch on more of the mental health side, of course. Of course, I'm going to put my profession first, and my wonderful colleagues out there that are on the front lines, because we're two on the front lines, being that we have been in a global pandemic for like 2 years now. There's a lot of people who are really spiraling and having a hard time dealing with this pandemic, which, of course, it's very hard. You know, again, you have people who have lost people, and you just have people that's just tired of being isolated and wearing the mask. And if you already had a mental health issue, you know, for a lot of people, it just only exacerbated even more. So I wanted to touch on suicide in the Black community, since we, again, are highlighting health and wellness for this year's theme. So with that said, let's start here with some stats. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S., according to the Center for Disease Control, and that's the CDC. And prevention's, that was found in the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's leading cause of death report from 2018. Now, the number of suicides in the U.S. is 1.5 more than the number of homicides, according to the report. For those aged 10 to 34, suicide was the second cause of death and the fourth for those aged 35 to 54. Suicide is an important health concern in the United States, and we all know that, right? And we all know someone that probably have succumbed to suicide, or we probably do and don't even know it, because some people have died of suicide and sometimes it wasn't known that they did. You know, sometimes I look at the news and I see drug overdose and I wonder if it was accidental or was it on purpose. You know, sometimes individuals are not leaving notes. You know, I think sometimes we look at the movies and because they left a note, you know, usually we know, but I don't think that happens in all the cases, right? Especially if they don't want their families to know that, you know, that's how they passed, and, you know, many layers to it, I should say. So all the times when someone has committed suicide, sometimes we don't know. You know, there's no note left, and if there's no note left, a lot of times if the autopsy doesn't confirm that, we will not realize that occurred. It affects all genders, races, and ages, as you may have known or you may not have known that, so I don't want to assume. Now, according to the Sun magazine, even began a campaign called You're Not Alone, and so you may want to look more into that to spread awareness of suicide. And again, that's the Sun magazine. Now, to be more specific about suicide in the Black community, let's hear some stats that affect the Black community. Black and African American this is a term used to describe people descended from any part of the Black racial group of Africa. So we call it the Black diaspora, okay? So on this webpage, when the site that I use, and this was in Sun Magazine, I'm going to go on some data. Well, I'm going to provide you with some data starting from 2019, okay? So in 2019, Black population composed an estimated of 13.4 of the U.S. population. I think that's kind of been steady, about 12 to 13% of the U.S. population. Now, at 7.4 per 100,000, the age-adjusted suicide rate for Black population in 2019 was over half the overall U.S. suicide rate of 13.2 per 100,000, okay? As in the overall U.S. population, the suicide death rate for men is more than four times the rate for women in Black populations. Wow. So with that said, and sometimes you're going to see me kind of pause and break it down for you, the suicide rate for Black men is higher by more than four times the rate for Black women, okay? The suicide rate for the overall U.S. population is approximately double that of Black populations for both males and females. As in the overall U.S. population, the suicide rate for men is more than four times again the rate for Black women. So I had to really emphasize that, because you have to really just see that that's a lot. That is a lot, more than four. And in this article, it really doesn't go into the Black male suicide, but I will go into that probably in another podcast episode, because some may say, well, what are some of the means and why are Black men more successful? And I think this kind of qualifies for men as well overall, but men typically use more lethal means than women. Women more often may use means of like over-the-counter drugs and things of that sort, like overdose, where men may use things, and this is a trigger warning, I'm sorry, but men may use lethal methods like guns, hanging and things of that sort. So if you use a more lethal mean, there's a higher rate of you succumbing to those means, right? As opposed to a drug by overdose. If someone catches that individual in time, they may go to the emergency room, get their stomach pumped. And I hate to be so graphic, but I provided a trigger warning, so if this is too much, you may want to leave, but I have seen these things occur before. I've worked in ICU before. I'm sorry, not ICU, the emergency department, ED department, and I have actually seen people get their stomach pumped, and they provide them with charcoal and things of that sort, and you probably have heard of that, but it's a very traumatic thing to actually witness. But yeah, so that's a little bit of why men may have more of a less chance of survival because of the lethal means that they choose, okay? So let's take a short break. I know that was a lot to probably digest, and I'd like to give you guys a little break, but I'll return with more right after this. If you or someone you love are having thoughts of committing suicide, please call the National Suicide Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or call 1-800-273-TALK. You are not alone. As found on BET.com, dated February 8, 2022, a new study of Black and Latino Christians have found that Black people often turn to their pastors for mental health care and information and mental health resources. Unfortunately, these pastors reported they feel ill-equipped and ill-prepared to offer the appropriate care to address their congregants' mental health needs. It's great that more Black people are seeking help, and you know I've said this to you before, but we need to direct these individuals to professionals who are able to deal with their needs appropriately. Now, with the influx of Black people seeking mental health care assistance from their church, church leaders are scrambling to basically know where to send these people, right? And so it's very imperative also that professionals such as myself begin to have talks at various churches and just educate congregations. Now, I will say this, and I'm very blessed to have this. At my church, we had a whole mental health center or department, if you will, of trained and licensed professionals. But we know that's not the case, especially in smaller churches. But with this this article, I would hope that more churches will bring in professionals and to have those talks with the congregation, because of course we need Jesus. Don't get me wrong, I'm the first one to say that. However, what I tell my clients, and it's almost like the light bulb goes off when I tell them this, and I sound like a broken record, but I'm like, you know, when that arm, if you break your arm, are you going to pray for healing, for Jesus to heal that broken bone? Now, you might, don't get me wrong, because I'm still going to pray when I hurt myself. However, you're going to be proactive and go to the hospital, right? I would hope you do, to get a cast and whatever that's needed to heal that that arm as well. And in addition to this, I always say, Jesus also, like he made physicians, medical doctors, nurses, and other professionals, he also made therapists for to be your head doctor, right? So why is that any different? It just seems like we continue to use excuses because, of course, you know, there is a stigma and taboo attached to mental health. We all know that. However, I like to be optimistic and I don't want to hang out there being a Debbie Downer. I have seen some upward trends and I'm so impressed and I'm so happy and elated that we are now seeing an influx of individuals who are at least speaking about mental health. Before, it wasn't even talked about. You bring up mental health in a Black family back in the day, and sometimes still a little bit today, the first thing they're going to say, I'm not crazy, right? But with strides that we're making, I see that individuals are becoming healed and whole and healing from past trauma. And I know sometimes we say past trauma, we're only speaking about the trauma that one has directly received. However, there has been studies, I'm not going to go to it too much in this episode, but there has been study to show that there is a real generational trauma. And when I say generational trauma, I mean even from slavery, things that are passed down. So I think I will talk about that in one of the upcoming episodes because it's very interesting. And I definitely will want to enlighten, inspire, and empower you, as that's my tagline to my podcast. But moving forward, again, it's great that Black people are seeking mental health, but we have to direct them, and I would say redirect these individuals to the appropriate resources. Now, there were another study, and the study was entitled, first of all, it was found on news.rice.edu. It's on their website if you want to look it up. And the study is called Where Would You Go? Race, Religion, and the Limits of Pastor Mental Health Care in Black and Latino Congregations. Now, churchgoers in Houston, and I'm reading from the article, were interviewed. Houston, Texas, that is. I don't want to make any assumptions because there may be a Houston somewhere else, right? As you know, there's a lot of little cities and things all around the U.S. and beyond. But yeah, in Houston, Texas. And it was recently published in the journal Religions. Okay. And that's the name of the journal. It's called Religions. Okay. So the lead researcher, Dan Bolger of Rice University, this is what he told BET.com. He said, pastors are feeling overwhelmed because the need in Black communities often is more than their abilities. And that's what I said. A pastor is made to pastor, right? They're not your therapist, people. And that's just it. And so I know sometimes we come down on our pastors, and rightfully so in some cases, right? But they are not there to deal with your mental health needs. You have to go to a mental health therapist. And with that said, maybe you want to go to a Christian mental health therapist. I myself, a lot of people, I'll share this with you. I don't know if I shared this with you before, but when clients will look me up on the website, they said, many would say that they chose me because they saw that I was a Christian. Now that is part of what I put my skill sets are, because there's sites and different platforms you can put what your skill sets are, populations that you serve. And I always put Christian down, which I do. And if my clients want a Christian's perspective, I provide them with that. Other than that, I don't bring in my religious beliefs in a session, because we just don't do that. Now, if I have a client who've asked my perspective and they want a Christian's perspective and that's what they're coming for, then that's when I go ahead and I do that. And actually, I love when they do that, to be honest with you. But yeah, so just to give you a little bit, you can interview. If you listen to my past episodes, I talk about some of the things that you can ask your therapist, your potential therapist, if you will, in the interview. And one being, it could be, what is your religious beliefs? Are you a Christian? And if they say no, you can always ask a therapist, because we are, I don't like to use the word obligated, but we should be providing you with resources if we can't provide you with the services that you're seeking. So what I would do, if someone is coming to me for, say, something that I really don't deal with or I choose not to anymore, I provide them with at least three resources of some of my colleagues, or I can direct them to a site where they can do a search on their own. Or a little bit of both. You know, sometimes I do both. So that's one of the questions that you may ask your potential therapist as well when you're in the vetting process. Okay. All right. So let's go on with the article. Congregants told us that they will seek their pastor first because they perceived mental health issues as highly stigmatized, not only in the church, but also the broader community. And they saw their pastors as uniquely qualified to help address such concerns. Again, I can't stress it enough. Your pastor is not the appropriate person to go to for your mental health needs. Now, one thing, it's like the light bulb, I had an epiphany just now. One thing that I'm thinking is, if we go, and when I say us, meaning myself and my other colleagues that are professionals in the field, maybe we should equip more pastors with resources. So when their congregations are coming to them, maybe they can have some resources where they can direct them. So that's a thought. I think I'm going to do that. Actually, I'll just put out my little filters out there and see who may be in need. And yeah, I think that's a good idea, because I can kind of get it, though, that the congregation would go to their pastor, because this is a person that they, you know, in the African-American community, the Black community, the Black church, especially back in the day. I don't know about so much now, but still, it really holds in high, you know, people hold the Black church in high regard. You know, your pastors look as the pillar in the community. This is the one that you go to for your spiritual needs. And so with that said, you know, mental health issues, a lot of people look at that as spiritual. So I can see why it definitely is occurring. So being that it is occurring, instead of shunning these individuals, I think that we need to make sure that our spiritual leaders are properly equipped And so I think us professionals, especially those that are in the Christian faith, we need to make sure that things are done to equip them with the appropriate resources. Okay, so moving on. This is the same article, and this is Bolger talking with BT.com. He stated, pastors often serve as first responders, see, to mental health issues. But the pastors Bolger interviewed said they're not adequately prepared and trained to do so. Again, you know, as I stated before, Bolger explained that pastors lamented the limits of their ability to care for mentally ill members, saying that this led to a tension within many Black churches. Congregants sought out pastors because they saw them as well-equipped to provide mental health care, while pastors felt overwhelmed by the high level of need. Wow, this is important. And another light bulb just went off, because there has also, I don't want to use influx because that would sort of make it seem like there's a high number of it. But I know in the past and recently, there's been pastors who've committed suicide. And so that's the whole who is pouring into the poor. So imagine all of these people are coming to this individual, this human being, because pastors, although people may look at them as some form of deity, they're not. They need their own help even. So even us reaching out and seeing that if they need help as well, I think it's something that we definitely need to do soon. I know I can be responsible for myself, so this is something that I definitely will ask around and see if there is a need out there, okay? Bolger and his co-author Pamela Prickett from the University of Amsterdam explained that mental health care providers need to connect with and equip pastors to help community members struggling with mental illness to bridge care to Black communities. And that's exactly what I just said. We need to be proactive in helping our spiritual leaders in the communities, in these Black churches, to help with the influx of individuals coming to them for help. Following a spate of high-profile deaths by suicide among Black people, discussing and treating mental health concerns has become a prominent issue. Now, moving forward, it said this paper also recommended building and strengthening partnerships between churches and mental health professionals. Hey, I just said that. In institutions to make it likelier that people can rise above any stigma to get the help that they need. It is very important. Not just in this field, but collaboration, you know, two is better than one. And it's time for us to bridge these gaps between mental health communities and the spiritual communities, the Black churches. We definitely need to come together because, Jesus is awesome and amazing. I can attest to that, right? But he made people like me. And I know he did, because I know this is my calling. I was born to do this. I hear it all the time, even from other people, because people usually ask me, how do you do what you do? And you are always happy and always joyous. And it's not phony. Most of the time, I mean, I'm happy. Do I have moments? Yeah, things happen. But I've always been like a joyous, bubbly person. I've always had that personality. I let things roll off my back like I really do. And I know part of it, I'm not going to say part of it, a big, huge chunk of it is because of my spiritual beliefs and Jesus Christ. I'm not ashamed about it. I've spoke about this on, you know, many times on my podcast episodes, but, you know, those are my beliefs and I'm going to stick to them to the day I die. So I know that was a lot of information, but it was highly informative for you. I hope it helped you. So let's let that marinate a little bit, and I'll be back after this break.
Fantastic, kind, generous. She was just one of those rare people that had a heart for people. That's Chesley's grandfather, Gary Simpkins, remembering her with his first statement since her tragic death. To be extinguished so fast is just devastating. And you know that the only way you'll ever see them again is when you yourself pass away. We remember Chesley as funny and, as so many have said, a beacon of light.
Great. Good.
One of Chesley's mentors, Gail King, poured out her heart online in this new essay for Oprah Daily. There was something so special about that sparkle of a girl.
Just in December, we sat down and had lunch together, and we said, isn't this great, right before the holidays? Isn't this great? After the first of the year, instead of Zoom, we can now start meeting in person. And we were very excited about that. I just genuinely liked her and cared about her.
Gail's CBS Mornings co-host, our former colleague Nate Burleson, also checked in.
We were just looking at some old footage of you and Chesley in New York shooting promos together, and it's just, it's funny, it's light, it's just, it's a great sort of peek into the relationship that you had with her.
She would walk into the room and she'd be on 10. You know, it's almost like she was floating in. I'm gonna miss that girl, I really am.
Hey y'all, I do a lot to make sure that I maintain my mental health.
Though by all accounts, she seemed so in control, she did share some of her struggles, writing in Allure magazine in an essay last year. Turning 30 feels like a cold reminder that I'm running out of time to matter in society's eyes, and it's infuriating. And she had spoken with so many about their battles.
Gabrielle, you've been so open and honest about, you know, some of the challenges you've had, your mental health, even suicidal thoughts.
Chesley spoke with Gabrielle and her husband Dwayne Wade just last year.
What do you say to someone at home who is feeling hopeless and just needs some encouragement?
Take a lot more joy in the journey, but also therapy. Get it and have no shame about it.
She talked with Mary J. Blige about the revelations that she made in her documentary, My Life.
Most of the times I was just depressed and didn't want to live.
You really went deep into mental health, which previously had a really big stigma around it, especially in the Black community.
I had to show people where all this pain came from that was in the My Life album in the first place.
And Taraji P. Henson shared her story about having suicidal thoughts in quarantine.
I started having thoughts about ending it.
Can you tell us how you were able to escape and how you stay positive now?
Well, you know, you take each moment. It's not like I wake up every day and I'm happy, but thank God I'm in therapy. I can now identify when I'm about to start the tip down.
In 2020, Chesley spoke to the online edition of the collegiate newspaper, The Hilltop, for Mental Health Awareness Month.
I try to set very clear boundaries, so even though I'm at home and I've got my computer and my phone with me, I'm done answering emails at 6 o'clock, and that helps me a lot.
The then Miss Teen Universe DC, Madison Pina, now a junior journalism major at Howard University, appeared with Chesley.
I want to make sure that mental health is not frowned upon, but it is understood by students and teachers alike.
And Madison, with me now, after you appeared with Chesley, did you form some kind of follow-up relationship with her?
Yes, actually. It was so amazing to have her reach out for her to take that time and speak with me. It's really incredible to see that she was willing to respond.
I have to imagine this left you devastated, stunned, and shocked like the rest of us. How are you feeling right now?
I will admit I had a complete and utter breakdown yesterday. Just hearing what happened, as someone who really advocates for mental health, I just couldn't imagine what she was possibly going through. And I'm just so saddened by this.
If you are struggling and need help, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255.
Welcome back, you guys. So, 2019 Miss USA Beauty Pageant winner Chesley Chris Winner died by suicide, according to an autopsy. CNN also stated that the 30-year-old suffered multiple blunt impact injuries from her fall from, I think this was her apartment in Manhattan, New York. My second home, you know. If you've heard my other episodes, you know I kind of sort of lived in New York for a little bit on business. And one of my favorite places, and I did live in Manhattan, so I know exactly where this is. Now, moving right along, many close to her detailed how bubbly, positive, you know, she was, and that she would just lighten up a room. And if you saw any of her videos, and you can go onto YouTube and see that she was also a commentator, I think on, was that Entertainment Tonight, if I'm not mistaken. But she was so bubbly and beautiful and just bright. And so
Yeah, this was a very tragic loss. Now, her loved ones denied, and her colleagues as well, denied that there were any signs of distress that would have alerted them that she needed some type of intervention. And as a therapist, I will say signs can be hidden pretty well if you don't know the signs. I'll say that because it's usually, I would say there may be one or two signs. The person may not exhibit all of them, and sometimes they may. But if you know them well, you may see something a little off kilter. Now, with Chesley, I don't know if she was around people a lot because I know she lived by herself. So sometimes these signs are detected mostly when people are around you all of the time. Because I will say this, a person who wants to hide signs and they are really intent on hurting themselves, they can be successful in doing that, especially when they can go off into their shell and just come out periodically and give us the representative that they feel the world wants to see for them, or if they just want to hide the pain that they're going through. And I heard from her standpoint, she was a person that really cared about other people, and she didn't really want people to worry about her. So in this case, I don't know her personally, never been around her, but I was just even wondering, thinking about this myself, would I have picked up something in her attitude, her personality, her spirit, was anything off? And I'm wondering if even her family, from any phone calls or anything, you know, sometimes a person may call every day and then they don't call anymore. And so that's why it's important for us to check up when someone comes across our mind, even, you know, I always believe that that's God, like telling us to check on people or to just pray for someone, you know, I'm always doing that. So this just reminded me that the strong and most bubbly people, the people who are usually pouring into people, need to be checked up on, just like I said. And Chesley was one of those people who've always checked on people, wanting to know how they were doing. And get this, she talked about mental health. She was a mental health advocate. And so I tell people, the people, especially those on the front line, I'm going to go into that a little bit later about compassion fatigue and what that entails. This is just a clear sign of that right here. You know, when you're pouring, I always tell people, because I'm a pourer, I'm usually the strong one in the bunch, right? Check on me, you know, things can happen, just not just even, you know, harming ourselves, even though, you know, I'm pretty stable. So thank God for my belief in God. And so I'm not saying for that, you guys, there, you don't have to worry about me in that aspect. But I'm just saying, you know, when people just may want to be checked up on, because when you're pouring all the time, you know, sometimes you can become a little bit fatigued and you want somebody to pour back into you sometimes. And I say this kind of cringy, and I'm going to tell you why. I myself personally, I don't have an issue with people checking them on me. It's just that I get into my shell with work, and sometimes I just don't want to be bothered. So that comes with the territory as well. When you're always pouring, sometimes you just want to tune out the chatter of everybody. And I'm pretty sure you guys out there know, if you're one that's always around people, always want to, you know, making people smile, whether you're in media, mental health, a helping profession like myself, sometimes you just don't want to hear anybody and be around anyone. And sometimes people don't understand that. And I have to explain to people, like, you know, I saw your call, I saw your text, but it's okay to text them back. I'm getting better, you guys, because sometimes I just don't want to engage, but I'm getting better. I'm getting better. But yeah, but I digress. So yeah, check up on those, your friends. I say check up on the strong friends. Again, I'm fine. I have a wonderful tribe who check on me and things of that sort. I was just using me as an example because I have been the strong friend, and I have actually had to tell friends of mine that, because when I see a friendship or relationship that's not reciprocal, I observe for a little while and then I stand back, because a person who continues to pour and pour and pour and pour, what do you think is going to happen? If no one is ever pouring back into them, they're going to become depleted. I use an analogy in one of my latest books, Dear Dope Black Girl, and I've referenced it in some of my episodes. If you continue to withdraw funds out of your bank account without ever depositing money back in, what do you think is going to happen? There's not going to be any money left unless you just have long money like Jeff Bezos, somebody like that. But even with him, you know, there's an end. There's not a constant flow of money, even though there's a lot there, pretty sure, in other places as well. However, my whole point is there is an ending. It's going to be depleted eventually if money is continuing to be taken out, even from Jeff Bezos, right? Okay, so with that said, it's a good segue to go into compassion fatigue. Now, this is a real thing. And yeah, you know what? Let's take a break and I'll get into what compassion fatigue is right after this.
Did y'all enjoy the break? Now find your spot on the virtual couch and get ready to hear our girl, Letitia, drop some more gems on ya. Drop some more gems on them, Letitia.
Letitia, drop some more gems on them.
So before the break, I spoke a little bit about compassion fatigue. So let's get into what compassion fatigue actually is. Now, the definition is, it is a condition characterized by emotional and physical exhaustion, leading to a diminished ability to empathize or feel compassion for others, often described as the negative cost of caring. It is sometimes referred to as secondary traumatic stress. So typically, the person who is experiencing compassion fatigue is someone, in a nutshell, shows compassion, right? But more of the person who is in the helping profession, your frontline individuals such as paramedics, doctors, nurses, moi, therapist, and other people who are in the helping field, even pastors, I would say, because pastors are they're pulled on a lot, in a lot of directions at any given time. So there are those individuals like myself who are always pouring. And so these individuals not only pour in their professional world or professional sphere of influence, I mean, we also have lives, we have families, we have friends, and, you know, sometimes it can get a little overwhelming and you have to be able to tell people no. My friends laugh at me because my boundaries are very firm. I have mastered the art of saying no to people and not really caring if you get mad about it, because my mental health is number one. So I'm very good at that. And that's why I'm able to talk about it, you know, from this lens of always telling people to take care of themselves. I'm like kind of the self-care guru, if you will. That's one of my main niches in my profession, is to teach people about self-care, you know, mental health, but yes, self-care. What does it look like? Because, you know, you have therapists who sometimes they're running ragged. And guess what? Stress ages you. No, it gives us wrinkles. And I refuse to. If anything, people tell me I'm aging backwards, actually. And I think I actually am, to be honest with you. So yeah, you have to take care of yourself, because when you are in a profession where you're always being pulled in so many different directions, it can take a toll on you. So do that, okay? So according to wellnesssociety.org, there are 9 signs of compassion fatigue. These are the 9 signs. Let's see if you fall in any of these, my fellow helping professionals, or those, you know, because I just thought of another one, even those in the media, when you're always reporting and giving people news. And I think that can qualify as well. Radio, the media, absolutely. I mean, if you are always pouring, because usually those people in those professions, people are always pulling on them somehow. I don't know. I just thought about that. So that could work as well. But if you're just someone just using it as a hobby, as opposed to this is your job day in and day out, I wouldn't say. Okay. But definitely, again, those in the helping profession, doctors, nurses, therapists, we get it. And yeah. So moving right along to the signs. Sign number one, signs of physical anxiety, such as breathing difficulties, muscle tension, and digestive problems. So that's one sign. Another sign, a sense of hopelessness. Number three, a decreased ability to empathize. That's a good one. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to share a little bit about this right here. This is when I know I need a vacation. Number three. And that's when I don't care to hear about anyone's stuff. When I get to that point, that's when I said, okay, I need to book me a trip. I need to go out of town and just do something different just to break up the monotony. And so this is the for sure sign when I need to get away. And again, you don't always have to get on a plane to go anywhere. Sometimes getting away just means turning off your phone, okay? I do that all the time. And I always have a disclaimer for people who just meet me and who want to be in my circle that I'm not going to answer your phone all the time. And just because you see me on social media doesn't mean that I'm going to feel guilty to answer your call either. Because I think sometimes people do that like, oh, I know you wasn't busy because I saw you posting. So I don't care. Yes. And sometimes I post on purpose to let them know, no, I'm not answering your call. Because when we're posting, we don't have to talk to people. And especially when you're like me, we talk for a living. That's what it is. I think that's why I was thinking about media, because you're always talking. That, yeah. In the media, if you're on radio and you're on TV, and I kind of do all of the above, but not consistently, not on radio and not on TV consistently, but I do things in the media. But if you're constantly in a profession where you're talking, that it can be very, it can bring on fatigue. It really can. Even though we make it look good, it can still make us tired. And again, I'm not talking about the one like the Instagram people who just want to talk to be seen. No, I'm talking about when you're doing this as a profession and sometimes you want to get up and do your job because you're tired. This is your professional. This is how you're making your money, not a hobby. So that is totally different, because I don't want people out there saying, oh yeah, no, I'm not talking to you. Okay, go on before I go on my rant. Number four, irritability and impatience. So number four kind of sort of go with number three for me. When I'm kind of short and I'm tired and I'm just like, no, that's when I know. But these can be a sign of compassion fatigue. So these are signs here. Decreased productivity and job satisfaction. Now, other than sometimes it's a sign that you need to leave your job, or all of the above, it can mean that you need to leave your job because this job is bringing on too much compassion fatigue. And that's okay. Do not feel guilty. And the reason why I'm saying do not feel guilty, and I'm using that word a lot, is because a lot of people who are, a lot of individuals who are in the helping profession and who get compassion fatigue are in those professions where sometimes they don't want to complain about being in them because they don't want to seem like they're ungrateful or they don't like doing their job. Like in the therapist role, you know, I know many therapists who don't want to admit that sometimes you don't want to hear anyone's problems. And that's just a fact. And when individuals become truthful with themselves, honest with themselves, we probably will see a lot less of this. And yeah, so sometimes just give yourself the grace to say when you've had enough in a particular field or a particular population. You know, as in terms of therapy, there are populations that will definitely drain you more than others. I would say that. And I've had my share. So moving around a lot in your profession, taking some time away, taking vacations, doing all those things that make you feel good inside, of course, legal. And of course, not developing another problem. And when I say that, I'm saying it facetiously, but I'm also being serious, because this is where addiction comes in a lot of the times too. If you're not using healthy coping strategies, not the maladaptive ones, but the healthy ones. Okay. So no drugs and alcohol, people. I'm not judging. I just want to make sure you are taking care of yourself and while not creating other problems, basically. Okay. So taking care of yourselves, but do not open the door to other things that make your snowball bigger than what it already is. Okay. Number six, a reduced ability to feel pleasure. So if you just don't feel happy, it could be a sign of deeper things like depression, but it could just be a sign that you're tired and you just need a break. Number seven, trouble sleeping. That's usually across the board in most things when you're tired. Sometimes you have trouble sleeping, or some people sleep too much, but sometimes you have impaired sleeping where you can't sleep, or you can fall asleep, but you're waking up throughout the night. Either way it go, you're not getting the amount of sleep required to be healthy, okay? And I did an episode, I created an episode on sleeping, so check that one out too, about sleeping and taking naps, one of my favorite pastimes. So I will say that department, I am well in. I love to sleep. I do. I'm not a sloth or anything, you guys, so don't judge me. But just say that that's not a department I have any issues in at all. Number eight, an urge to isolate yourself from others. Now, this one, I'm going to stick a pin in it, and put a little star by it. How about that? Isolating yourself and getting to yourself sometimes is okay, but not to the point of when you're not letting anyone in. That can be a sign of depression and that you're in that funk. And, you know, when we isolate ourselves and we're not feeling too good, you know, it is good to have some sunshine come in. Of course, the individuals who are can put a smile on your face, not the Debbie Downers or the Daniel Downers, not those people, but, you know, your friends, your family. If you have a pet, that's also good because they don't talk either. And they just love on you and just, you know, make you feel good. So even a puppy or a cat or whatever your choice of animals is. And the last one, self-doubt and reduced self-esteem. So that's one right there. Like when you being a little self-conscious about yourself and, you know, your looks or anything of that sort, it could be a sign that you are going through some compassion fatigue, and that is also a sign of depression as well, okay? So the tragic death of lawyer and former Miss USA Chesley Crist has drawn attention to suicide prevention and sparked conversations about mental health. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, many mental health challenges were the leading cause of disability and poor life outcomes for youth. According to the U.S. Surgeon General, suicide rates among youth ages 10 to 24 increased by 57% between 2007 and 2018. And early estimates show more than 6,600 suicide deaths among that age group in 2020. We are in the midst of a youth mental health crisis in the United States, which has become more pronounced since we've entered the pandemic and with the rise of bullying, because I can't leave that out. Bullying, even cyberbullying, has seemed to just rise, just skyrocket. I always say when there's something good, something bad comes right along with it, because our technological advances are wonderful, right? They're amazing. But at the same time that we have increased access, we are left more vulnerable for everyone to access us, right? So you have to find some balance with that. And if you're a parent, or just not even a parent, if you're a mentor, you have someone in your family that is a teen, you know, kind of talk to them about how to safely surf the net, okay? Like I said before, with the boom of technology and social media, that has aided in us knowing more about people's lives, so did the not so good things come right along with it, with comparing ourselves to others and all of those things, right? And so, you know, the brain of the teen is not fully developed to understand some of these things that we, you know, that their eyes are seeing and processing. So everything is just coming to them full, fast and furious, right? And their brain is not even developed enough to process it properly. You know, some adults can't even process it properly, just to be honest with you. But that's a whole nother ball game. You know, maturity levels are different. You know, age is just a number. However, what I'm trying to say that even adults, a lot of the things that we see, it is hard if you don't have a mature brain, if you're not mature yourself, to actually take it all in and process it properly and it not affect your mental health, okay? Everything needs a balance. And so even with adults, we have to also balance ourselves in consuming these these social media images. It can affect your mental health. Our mental health is an essential part of our overall health. I can't stress that enough, you guys. Talking about it, it is critical to getting help yourselves and getting help for someone that you know. You know what? It takes a village. If you see someone around you struggling, please let them know that you see them and give them some suggestions. According to Know the Signs, a statewide suicide prevention awareness campaign, here are also some signs for teens that may be in trouble and in danger of suicide. Withdrawal, changes in sleep, reckless behavior, changes in personality, okay? These are some of the things. And when I come back after this break, because that was a lot to take in, and yeah, go get your water and your snacks and all that good stuff, and come back and we'll talk about the warning signs for adults, okay? They're about the same, but yeah, for the children, I'll go back over again. Teens, it's withdrawal, changes in sleep, reckless behavior, and that's a big one. Reckless behavior is really big for teens because at that age, they're kind of thinking they're invincible anyway. I think we all did. That is a normative stage of development for teens. That's a normal trait, characteristic is reckless behavior, thinking they're invincible, death is so far away and nothing can ever happen to them. But reckless behavior to the point to where it's really extreme and sometimes coupled with they don't really care what happens to them, you may want to look at that, okay? This is the age where they may even be getting their license. So, you know, reckless driving, drug use, acrobatic stunts, even seriously, you may want to look at that and just have a little conversation. Like, I see you doing this and doing that. Why is that? Are you okay? It's okay. You know, teens sometimes don't want to hear what we have to say. And I'm saying that, you know, laughing almost because I was that teen before. Not really reckless at all, but, you know, thinking you know it all. That's normative as well. So, yeah, when I come back, I will talk about the warning signs for adults. So, come back after this break.
It is defined as absorbing the patient's suffering through the experience of taking care of that person. As a provider, empathy might be your most valued skill. It is also the same trait that can make you vulnerable to the experiences of your patients. And you might find yourself suddenly feeling exhausted, frustrated, or sad. Thoughts and feelings might become overwhelming, cognitive abilities can be impaired, and you might feel completely lost where you used to feel the most confident. Providers are especially vulnerable when they are busy in their clinics or hospital schedules and find themselves prioritizing their patients over their self-care and connection with others. Any provider who cares for people with trauma histories can be at risk for compassion fatigue. Providers can protect themselves and build resilience by keeping a few simple things in mind. Be with other professionals. Social support among colleagues is a protective factor for providers. It allows you to feel connected with peers, as well as seek consultation or supervision, or even just the chance to vent in a professional and appropriate outlet. Isolation is a risk factor and a warning sign for compassion fatigue, and staying connected reduces its likelihood and severity. Choose optimism. An optimistic outlook is protective against compassion fatigue, as well as many stress-related health consequences. One exercise that promotes optimism is writing a gratitude log. Once a day, write down 3 things to be grateful for. It works. Make time for self-care. In a busy office, clinic, or hospital, you may only have 5 free minutes at a time. Use those minutes wisely to care for yourself. Everyone's favorite activities are different. You might feel best when you listen to music, journal, meditate for a few minutes, pray, or read. Any of these and others can protect you from the effects of difficult work. Compassion fatigue is a risk for any medical or mental health provider and affects the ability to provide outstanding care to your patients. Providers can be protected from the effects of this experience by putting a few simple practices in their day-to-day routines. The work is so important, and self-care is a priority. It's just good practice.
So let me clarify a few things, or at least just one thing. Now, before the break, I did say compassion fatigue can include individuals on TV, in the media, podcasts, if you will. However, I wanted to be a little bit more specific. Now, I'm not speaking of, and this is not talking about our radio and our TV hosts. We need them for entertainment, and they're very important to us, right? But the ones who cover very traumatic events, just in the case right now, those who may be covering even the Ukraine story, because right now, as you're listening to this podcast, we are actually going through like World War III right now with Russia and Ukraine. So those individuals who are around the clock, nonstop, or even boots on the ground, they may actually develop compassion fatigue because they're there not only hearing the sirens and the bombs and all of those things, but they're also engaging with the people who are actually going through something very traumatic and they're going through it themselves. So individuals who are covering very traumatic information can develop compassion fatigue, just like those in the helping profession, such as myself, a therapist, doctors, nurses, and individuals like paramedics, even police, because I left them out before. So our law enforcement, definitely because of what they do and the things that they see. And I would like to create an episode on them too, because people really don't talk about, but paramedics, and I'm not sure if the stats of doctors, but I think the suicide rates can be very high. I know with police officers and, you know, individuals in the helping profession, aside from therapists, because I haven't heard any of that, you know, we pretty much take care of ourselves. Like I told you, I am a self-care guru. I will shut everything down. My friends call me the shutdown queen because I will get offline and everything for a minute and travel across the country, you know, in another country as well. So I just wanted to just clarify that, you know, with me, I don't ever want to leave you confused in any way and with false or incomplete information. So with that said, let's go to the warning signs of suicide so that you can be more proficient in identifying some of the factors, okay? So the warning signs of suicide are indicators that a person may be in acute danger and may urgently need help. Now, these are some, and you may even know some of yourself, but these are some that we look for, and there is empirical research behind it that backs this, okay? Talking about wanting to die or to kill oneself or others, but we're talking about suicide here. But usually as a therapist, when someone is a danger,
they may have some homicidal thoughts as well. But in this article, it didn't really say homicide. But sometimes when one wants to harm other people, that's why you see individuals who may kill themselves and kill someone else in that, okay? Looking for a way to kill oneself. So someone who may be actively looking for something or things to do, things that are dangerous or reckless, or looking for an item like a gun or knife or things of that sort, pills can be included as well. Talking about feeling hopeless or having no purpose. Talking about feeling trapped or being in unbearable pain. Talking about being a burden to others. Increasing the use of alcohol or drugs. Let me back up a little bit. Now, in the terms of talking about being a burden to others, that may include individuals who are elderly as well, okay? They are apt to committing suicide as well. So sometimes when, you know, our elderly, I feel like it's our most delicate populations outside of children, they may feel like they're a burden, especially if there's some health challenges, okay? So you want to look out for that. Acting anxious, agitated, or reckless, I said that before, sleeping too much or too little, withdrawing or feeling isolated, showing rage or talking about seeking revenge, and that's where you have the murder-suicide. So if you see someone that is kind of short, I wouldn't say short-tempered because that's kind of minimizing it, but if you see someone in rage, because short-tempered is not rage. Rage is like anger to the billionth power. So you see somebody just enraged, and especially if it's out of the ordinary, you may want to look at that and look at their demeanor again and listen to their words. Okay, what are they saying? Are they mad at a particular person? You may want to ask some questions. But if you're in danger yourself, you may not want to do that. You probably will want to get some intervention from law enforcement. And I know if you are in the Black community like myself, that can sometimes be troubling too, okay? And we're not gonna go into that today, but this is Black History Month and we all know what goes on in our community. And you know, if you know me, you know, I try to be that woke therapist. I'm a woke person, okay? So I don't ever like to sweep our issues under the rug. And that is a real thing that we cannot minimize. And yeah, with that said, Black Lives Matter. I'm always say that, okay? Lastly of this list, we displaying extreme mood swings. So if you seeing them go up and down, their mood is kind of erratic. You want to, you know, that's also a sign. Someone threatening to hurt or kill themselves, you know, we said that before. You want to look at some things that are near them that they may have, okay? Some weapons, pills, and things of that. You want to look at that. If they're talking about despair, if they have a medical issue, you want to look at that as well. That is a risk factor. But I'll go into more some of the risk things later. If someone is talking, writing, or posting on social media, being that we are in the technological age, we're advanced now, there are other ways where people may be crying out for help, especially our adolescents, our teens, okay? They are consuming so much online, but they spend a lot of their times online. So this may be where a manifesto even may be written. If you don't know what a manifesto is, it's when someone really pours out their emotions and thoughts and plans it could be acts of violence, it could be harming themselves. So yeah, you may want to look at that. You know, we see in the movies and things of that sort about a suicide letter. That isn't always the case, okay? But usually when someone is crying out for help, they're gonna cry out for help before they actually commit the act. Now, I don't like to say this, but it is true. If someone wants to commit suicide, they will. But I always say in my, you know, thank God I haven't lost a client or patient to this, because if I'm always on it, any of my clients know me, know I'm on it. If I hear things and say things before they leave my office, my presence, I'm going to check in. And it's been times when I've had to call and get them hospitalized because even though they said that they were fine, I wasn't okay with it. And, you know, it takes a village, even, you know, myself and dealing with a psychiatrist. A psychiatrist is different than myself in the fact that they are the ones who prescribes the medication. And so what I usually do, I try to create some buffers and a system around them to ensure and also have them have someone where in the case of an emergency, of course, we can call because, you know, in mental health, you know, we have HIPAA, just like in medical, same thing. It's a medical field. We have HIPAA, so we can't talk to anyone without a patient's permission. If they are another healthcare professional that is providing care, that's usually in the office policy, and they have signed some forms so that we can reach out. Like a psychiatrist, that's a part of the team. So I can always call the psychiatrist and talk because it's a part of the treatment team, and they signed all those wonderful intake forms in the beginning. And if you're in private practice, of course, you know you're going to make some forms where they understand that and it needs to be spelled out. But enough of all that administrative stuff. Let me go on, because you're probably like, what the heck is she talking about? Because if you're not a therapist, but if you're in the helping profession or have received counseling or just medical attention, you know all those forms that you sign in the beginning, that's usually what's included. So yeah, so read those things, because I know you're probably just signing them, not reading them. Hope you're not doing that. Okay, another warning sign, excuse me, the aftermath of losing a loved one can be very devastating and leave someone very confused, angry, and depressed, distraught, and guilty. And so this is a time where you really want to look at your fellow family members, even your friends, coworkers, whoever. Losing a loved one is very traumatic, and it can exacerbate if they had issues already. Okay, so if they already had issues to begin with, this can compound and just add to the stress and the turmoil that they already have. So you definitely want to look at these individuals. Okay, now let's get into some risk factors. That was basically the warning signs. Risk factors are a little different. The last thing that I stated could be a risk factor, okay? Losing a loved one. Recently losing a loved one can be a risk factor, okay? So let's start with mental health disorders, particularly mood disorders, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, and certain personality disorders. They may be more prone to suicide, okay? Alcohol and other substance use disorders, hopelessness, impulsive and or aggressive tendencies, history of trauma or abuse, major physical or chronic illnesses, previous suicide attempt. Yes. And let me stick a pin in this. These are a lot of the questions, if you've ever had therapy before, if you had a good therapist before, I'll say that, I'm not going to assume, they should be asking these questions in your assessment. So everything that I'm listing here, these should be questions in your assessment, because in my mind, when I'm making my treatment plan, I am going to develop a treatment plan, of course, with you in mind, because you are part of this treatment plan, and I'm going to communicate what my findings are in the end, if I feel like you need extra support. But these things are going to let me know what type of treatment you need. Do you need lower level, mid level, or higher level? Okay. So if you've ever been asked these questions in therapy, we're not being nosy, but we're being nosy. Okay. But it's only for your good. This is why. Okay. Okay. So major physical or chronic illnesses, that's also a risk factor. And I think I said that before. So previous suicide attempt. Okay. Family history of suicide. So if there's a family history of it, recent job or financial loss, recent loss of relationship, easy access to lethal means. That's your lethal means of committing suicide. That's your guns, pills, and anything that would that would aid in you being successful in a suicide attempt, okay? Local clusters of suicide. Now, what does that mean? Clusters mean, are you in a vicinity or area where this is happening very frequently, okay? Is it very prevalent in your particular cluster? It could be a neighborhood, it could be your school, it could be wherever your tribe is. I like using the word tribe. So if there's clusters of it going on, that is a red flag, okay? Lack of social support and sense of isolation. Stigma associated with asking for help. This is a biggie. There are people, as we know, some of them probably, you know, close to us, that refuse to ask for help. They just want to do it on their own. So if you have a friend who they feel like they don't ever want to ask for help, and if you see a need, just do it. One of my main things, I'm going to tell you what a pet peeve of mine is when someone, have a family member who dies or something, or you know someone is struggling and you say, if you need me, I'm here. Now, mind you, you may not know there's a need, okay? So not for those times. But if you know that there's a need, if you know, just do it. Just do it. Because 9 times out of 10, they really want you to, but they just don't want to ask you for it, okay? So just learn that. Just do it. If you feel like there's a need because there's a reason why you're asking them and you're saying that, right? Just do it. Just do it like Nike. Lack of health care, especially mental health and substance abuse treatment. Okay. Cultural and religious beliefs, such as the belief that suicide is a noble resolution of a personal dilemma. Now, I personally don't know any cultures that subscribe to this, but there may be some because it's on the list. So I'm pretty sure it is. I know in the Christian faith, it is frowned, it's frowned upon. And that can be problematic for some as well, because some people may feel like they want to rebel against that. And that's a whole nother story too. Okay. Exposure to others who have died by suicide in real life or via the media and internet. And that is big. As you know, we have had some deaths recently. I think Regina King's son, and we had Chesley Christ and some others over the years. And so this is what I would call suicide, not in vivo, but living out and being affected. It is indirectly. I was going to say something like vicariously. You know, someone may be experiencing someone's pain and trauma by seeing it virtually or in the media. You know, we don't think about that, but the media is very powerful, and it can be a very positive thing, but it also can be problematic if we, you know, don't monitor ourselves and each other, you know, especially with kids, okay? So, let's take another break. That was heavy, wasn't it? So, yeah, let's take a break. And when I return, let's talk about some protective factors, okay? What can we all do to prevent losing someone to suicide, okay? So I'll be back right after this. Hey, this is your girl Letitia coming to you from the virtual couch. I want to take a little bit of your time today to discuss how to find the right therapist. Now, like with anything, your hairstylist, your gardener, your medical doctor, it may take a few tries before you find the right fit. Finding the right therapist is no different. So stay the course and don't give up. Also, I want to empower you to ask questions. Do not feel like you're being intrusive by asking questions, because guess what? This is the person that's going to lead you and guide you towards your healing. And this is a very important partnership. So I will say this, even as a therapist myself, if a therapist becomes offended
by any questions that you may have, just like with any other individual that I discussed before, like your doctor, your gardener, whoever, someone, you know, working on your home. If they become offended, you're probably not going to hire them, right? Exactly. Your therapist is no different. So don't feel offended. Don't be offended by the degrees and the licenses. And yes, all those hard things we worked for, but we're here for you. And so it is your right to ask every question you need to ask to make sure it is the right fit for you. And again, it may take a few tries. And again, it doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that therapist is a bad person either. It just means that, you know what, they may not be the right person to guide you on your journey. So I want to leave you with a few resources. Psychologytoday.com is a resource where you can view various therapists, and you can even input your area by your zip code, your city, and your state to find the therapist nearest you. You can also go to therapyforblackgirls.com and therapyforblackmen.org. Please seek these resources out. They are awesome. There are some wonderful, very experienced therapists on these sites, some of which are my beautiful colleagues, and I know the hard work that they do, and they are waiting to hear from you. Okay, so I'm not gonna take any more of your time because I know you can't wait to get to that computer, right? And search out that therapist. So I'm not going to say anything further. If you want to tell me about your experience, I would love to hear about it. Please email me at virtualcouchpodcast1@gmail.com. And happy hunting. Take care.
Have a seat on the virtual couch.
Get it, girl. Let's go.
Welcome back. Now, earlier in the episode, I sort of told on myself, I never knew that Black History Month had themes that were attached. I never knew that. This year, Black History Month is paying homage to individuals in the helping profession. So it's about health and wellness. And so I wanted to commemorate this year by speaking about a very delicate topic, and that is suicide in the Black community. Okay, so with that said, let's get into some protective factors. Now, protective factors are characteristics that make a person less likely to engage in suicidal behavior. Moreover, protective factors can promote resilience and ensure connectedness with others during difficult times, thereby making suicidal behaviors less likely. Now, here are a list of those. Effective clinical care for mental, physical, and substance abuse disorders, easy access to a variety of clinical interventions, restricted access to highly lethal means of suicide, strong connections to family and community support. Very important. This prevents someone from isolating, okay? Support through ongoing medical and mental health care relationships, skills in problem solving, conflict resolutions, and handling problems in a nonviolent way. Very important. As a clinician, I'm always incorporating skills in my therapeutic intervention. So when one is having an episode of, say, anger or depression, they have some skills in their toolbox that they can use to prevent them from using more maladaptive means, okay? And this keeps them safe and everyone around them safe as well. Cultural and religious beliefs that discourage suicide and support self-preservation. That's also important. Now, sometimes I know people don't want to ask for help because sometimes individuals feel like they're a burden. But I want to let you know that is not a sign of weakness at all. Not a sign of weakness. Now, before I end this episode, I also wanted to
go in some things that parents can look for in their children, or maybe some questions that they may be able to ask if your child is going through a depressive episode and thinking about suicide themselves, as we have seen the numbers increase, especially since the pandemic. So if you believe your child is experiencing thoughts of suicide, it is important to address the issue directly and always back it up with seeking a professional, because you're not a clinician, so you want to have a professional involved, okay? Now, you may want to ask your child, are you thinking about hurting yourself? You may want to be empathetic towards your child with his or her answer, okay? Let them know you are there for them, because I know as parents, sometimes we have to kind of back off and not be so harsh, and of course, not be their friends, but don't be so judgmental, because sometimes parents can be a little bit judgmental. We don't want your child to feel like they can't come to you. Okay? Provide support to your child considering suicide by taking them to the emergency room for an evaluation. And you don't have to go to an emergency room. You can book sessions with a therapist, an evaluation assessment with a therapist. But if it's an emergent situation, you want to call 911 or go to your nearest emergency room, okay? So that is correct. But that doesn't have to be your first line of defense, especially if your child is verbal and they're speaking to you about what's going on, but there's no emergency at the very moment. But you can go to the emergency room if you feel the need to. It's fine, okay? Provide ongoing support through mental health counseling, either through the school or in the community, so your child can receive help with their suicidal thoughts. So you may want to get the school involved. Again, talking to a therapist, you may want to search on Psychology Today, and there's some other websites that I spoke of. I don't think I really spoke of it early in this episode, but if you go to the episode by finding the right therapist, it's in there. But there's a lot of therapists that you can find. But you can find some on Psychology Today, therapyforblackgirls.com, therapyforblackmen.org, and there's a host of others, okay? Get support for yourself. That's very important. By seeking counseling or parent support groups. So important. You have to remember, you have to take care of yourself, mom or dad, or caregiver, you know, because it just parenting alone is hard, okay? But especially if you have a child who is having a tough time, it's so great to be around other people or seeking your own one-on-one therapy. But if you want to go to support groups, it's always good to have a community of support to see that other people are going through the same thing that you're going through, and you can probably learn from them and shed some light about your situation to help them as well. Okay, familiarize yourself with the warning signs and protective factors around suicide. Some of the things that I've spoken about earlier in this episode, you may want to go back and write some of those down so that you can you know, have those in your back pocket, in your toolbox, to know the things to look for. And you can listen to this episode as much as you need to, and share if you can as well. Be aware of community resources that specialize in assisting youth with thoughts of suicide, and there's many out there. So with that said, I'm going to end this, but I'm not going to end before providing you with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK, or to spell out talk, not really spell out talk, but the numbers for talk is 8255. So that is 1-800-273-8255. Or you can text STRENGTH to the crisis text line at 741-741, or you may go to suicidepreventionlifeline.org. So with that said, take care of yourself and each other, and God bless.
Leticia's Virtual Couch.